Out of the jungle, but stuck in France, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. French authorities clear out a migrant camp called the jungle and tell the residents there that they now have to stay in France, which is not what they want to hear.
They've never wanted to be in France. They've wanted to go to England.
But some younger migrants have made it across the channel, and that sparked a debate in Britain.
A few people are saying, we're not sure about this, we're not sure they should be here. But a lot of people have also been saying, we need to reach out, we need to help.
And later, hashtag balance of power, what's it like to be a policewoman in Pakistan?
When I came here, it was a big shock for these people because I'm the only female who's working in the field.
We kick off our series on women in Pakistan and how Washington is helping them. That's all today here on The World. Thank you for being here. The city of Calais in northern France, population about 130,000. But in the past couple of years, at least 7,000 more people have settled there on the edge of the English Channel in a migrant camp known as the Jungle. Some of them are refugees. They've fled wars in places like Syria and Iraq. Others are economic migrants. And most of them are looking for a way to get across the English Channel and into Britain. Today, French officials began to clear out the camp. Previous efforts to clear the jungle have failed, so will it work this time? Vivian Walt with Time magazine is in Calais.
It looks a lot emptier than it did last night or even earlier this morning. You know, before dawn when I was there from about 6 o'clock in the morning in the pitch dark. There were hundreds of people packing up and heading out and moving towards this big hangar down the road where they're registering people and beginning to kind of, you know, carve people up into different regions of France.
So this hangar where all this processing is happening, that's the first step. Then you said these people will be sent all over France. Did French authorities have enough buses for those who wanted to leave today?
Well, Marco, they think that about 3,000 people will be moved today and possibly the rest tomorrow and the day after. However, the process is rather extraordinary because you're dealing with people who have no idea about anything to do with France. They've never wanted to be in France. They've wanted to go to England. They enter the warehouse and French officials basically show them a map of France, color-coded for different regions, and say, well, where do you want to go? You want to go to Bordeaux? You want to go to Burgundy? You want to go to the Loire Valley? These are places that people have never heard of. So they pick a color and off they go. They're loaded onto buses and the next stop they will be in a small town in central France or the southwest of France where they will very slowly go through the laborious process of trying to claim asylum, trying to find a way to stay in France or somewhere else in Europe, if not France. And if not, if that kind of process fails for them, they will in fact be eligible to be deported back from where they came from.
Considering that a lot of these people wanted to eventually to be in the UK, there must have been a lot of disappointment at that hangar during this processing operation.
You know, you would think that there would be a tremendous sense of sadness at leaving this place, but in fact, on the contrary, there seemed to be almost a kind of upbeat feeling that something was happening. And several people I spoke to in the jungle this morning said that they were just so exhausted by the whole process. They've spent months trying to, you know, get across to England. Many of them have been sneaking aboard trucks or trying to sneak aboard trucks night after night after night for months on end. They've been chased by police. They've been in tear gas, you know, many, many times. And they were just exhausted. And there's a feeling of resignation that it's over and that they've more or less hit a brick wall. I think until now there's been a general sense that it's been the French that have blocked them from going to Britain. But I think over the months the feeling has changed quite a lot and people have begun to realize that perhaps they might have a shot of some kind of life in France.
Time magazine's Vivian Walt in Calais in northern France. Now let's get the view from the other side of the channel. Britain recently accepted a number of younger migrants from the jungle. It was supposed to be a humanitarian gesture, but not everyone saw it that way. My BBC colleague Simon Hall is home affairs correspondent for the BBC in southwest of Britain. That's where some of these young migrants have arrived.
We're talking about initially a couple of hundred, but we don't know exactly how many will be coming. It's a very fluid situation. The jungle camp in Calais is a very strange environment, or was. It's being taken apart now, but it is a hostile environment. It's a sinister environment. And there's been a big lobby here to be humanitarian, to reach out and help some of the young people, particularly who are there. We know there are unaccompanied children there. And obviously, it's not the place they should be. And in terms of what they're going to do, well, they're going to move around parts of the country to places where they can find homes. They're being taken care of. It's a slow and gentle process to rehabilitate them.
Mm. So this has been seen as a humanitarian gesture. Why was this decision so controversial?
It wasn't particularly controversial to start with. As you'll know, we've had a very big debate here in the United Kingdom about what our place is in the world, effectively, whether we should be part of Europe or not. And that was won by people who wanted to come away from Europe. So there is a subtext to this in that we don't quite know, we're not quite sure what our place in the world is. So some people in the UK are less keen on allowing in refugees than others, but the debate was won. So that issue was resolved, and we were going to take these people, and we have. But then came another controversy. As some started to arrive, they were photographed going into a centre in London. And it was apparent from the photography that some of them looked much older than 18, much older than children. The opinion was, the argument was, if they're not children, then we're not doing what we said we would. And we may also be taking people when in fact we could be taking children instead, which is what we said we would do. So there has been an argument about that.
I read that one Tory MP actually asked for the minors, if that's who in fact they are, for their teeth to be checked. That would be a way of determining how old they are. What's been reacted
to that? Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That was a thought which was put out. It was criticized quite heavily on one basis, on the science of it. A lot of people said it wasn't scientifically rigorous and you couldn't tell by that. But then the argument came back the other way, that there were other methods of telling age. But the root of it was there was a concern that some of these children, which we had agreed to take, were not as young and not perhaps as vulnerable as we thought. So there has been a controversy about that.
So you are in the county of Devon, and some of these minors are being housed there. What kind of welcome have they received so far?
Yes, it's been interesting. Devon has been chosen in part because it is the opposite end of the spectrum from the jungle camp in Calais. Devon, if you don't know, it's a quiet county. It's very low crime. It's peaceful. It's green. It's leafy. It's hilly. It's pretty much the sort of England you would see on your sketchbooks and your chocolate boxes and your postcards. Mm. So it was seen as a place which was a good place to bring some people who might need peace and quiet and calm. And so, yes, I think that's part of the reason. There's a lot of the reason why this area was chosen. As to the welcome, well, I've been talking about the story quite a bit on the BBC here in the Southwest and also on social media. And I've had a lot of comments back, and a few people are saying, we're not sure about this. We're not sure these are children. We're not sure they should be here. We're not sure they should cope. But a lot of people have also been saying, it's a heart thing. We need to reach out. We need to help fellow humans, and particularly young ones. And I think the general opinion, the largest sway of opinion that I've seen, is people saying we should reach out and help.
Simon Hall is the BBC's Home Affairs correspondent for the southwest of Britain. Simon, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
None of this is new. It's just the numbers that have gone way up. For years, migrants have found ways, not all legal, to get across the channel and into England. Here is the story of one of them, a man who now lives in England in Coventry. Here's reporter Adeline Sear.
For many migrants fleeing persecution in their homeland, England is the promised land. And hiding in the back of a truck headed there is virtually the only way to get to it. In 1999, Sabir Zazeh snuck onto a truck in northern France and got off in Dover. He was 22. For him, as for countless other Afghans, living under the oppressive rule of the Taliban had become too dangerous. Zazeh is 41 now, and over the years, he built his life and career here in Coventry. 2 years ago, this soft-spoken man began working as the director of the Coventry Refugee and Migrant Center. That happens to be the place that helped him after he arrived.
I see people from many, many different conflicts. And I think somehow, for me, it's some kind of a therapy. What I've been through, the welcome that I received, the support that I received, now offering that openly to others, gives me that energy, and it's that rewarding feeling that motivates me to help others.
The center serves migrants from Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Syria, among other places, and helps them with legal, housing, and language needs, though funds for some of these services are drying up.
We've got a solicitor, we've got immigration advisors who are helping people with issues like family reunion. We have therapy services.
Zaze knows how important these services are if these newcomers can foster any hope of integrating into British society. And he understands what's at stake because he's been through this process himself.
You end up in a strange world where you don't even speak the language. Your qualifications are not recognised. You've left family behind. You lost people in war, conflict. And that all stays with you for a long time.
Recently, Zaze was particularly motivated to help two new migrants, Afghan boys, only 14 and 15 years old.
They were really, really tired and looked shattered. First question I asked them was, have you eaten? And they said, not for a long time. So I went out and got them some food. And it really made me feel sad that I saw two young people just went into that food and finished it in seconds because they were so hungry.
The boys had traveled from the large migrant camp in Calais, France, which authorities are dismantling today. Like Zaze 17 years ago, they snuck across the English Channel on the back of a truck. Zaze rang up the local social services agency and was shocked to hear that the police would have to handle their case first.
So basically we had to call the police on them. So the police came over and the first thing the police did was to search them because the police said, we don't know them, we cannot just put them in our car. I felt really bad telling them that this is the most we can do for you is to call the police.
A few weeks later, Zaze was reassured when he ran into the boys in downtown Coventry. They looked well and told him they were now in the care of social services. Zaze says he can identify with those boys because he too is isolated from his relatives. When Zaze and his family fled Afghanistan, he managed to reach England's shores, but his parents only made it as far as Peshawar, Pakistan, where they still live today. And this separation is a constant source of anguish for him.
I walk in Coventry, people greet me and thank me and say hello. But I think one thing that has left a big gap is my family. I'm always worried about them.
3 years ago, when Zaze completed a master's degree in community development, he had hoped his family would be able to attend his graduation. But their visa applications were turned down.
They were refused. And that really, really hurt me. And that really felt to me that now I haven't integrated. I have integrated, but I've not been accepted.
That lack of acceptance eats away at Zaze. He's been a citizen since 2006. He's married with 3 children and has a steady job. And he feels he's done everything he could to adapt to British society.
I love Coventry. I love Britain. But I think somehow there's something missing. I'm not trusted.
Zaze says distrust has only increased since Britain voted last June to leave the European Union, partly over immigration issues. From hate mail to racial slurs, he and the migrants he serves can attest that xenophobia is on the rise.
It takes many, many years to build bridges across communities, and it only takes one referendum to mess them all up.
Still, Sabir Zaze says his beloved city of Coventry has a long history of peace and tolerance, and he intends to do everything in his power to keep it that way. For the world, Adeline Sear, Coventry, England.
Coming up later on the show, on patrol with one of the few police women in Pakistan. You're with the world. Iraqi government troops, along with a number of military partners, including the U.S., are trying to force ISIS out of Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city. The plan was announced a while back, and in a couple of minutes, we'll discuss whether it might have been better to keep that plan more of a secret. First, though, let's talk with James Verini. He's with National Geographic, and his most recent story is called Surviving the Fall of ISIS. Verini has been speaking with those who have fled ISIS-controlled territory. He began by describing for me an evening he spent on a mountainside earlier this month. Using flashlights, Iraqi soldiers on the mountain were trying to signal to a family of 7 who were fleeing Mosul.
This particular family was relatively fast. They only took a couple of hours. And they can't carry lights themselves, of course. you know, they have to turn the lights on their cell phones off. They're constantly worried about ISIS coming up the mountainside to follow them.
Yeah, explain how the soldiers who are on the mountain actually kind of guide with their lights and what the risks of that are.
The night we were there, there was an interpreter who spoke both Kurdish and Arabic on the phone with the father, and he was with his wife and five children, ages, I think, roughly 8 to an infant. At the same time, there was a soldier who was intermittently putting on a flashlight so that the father had something to walk to, but they couldn't keep the flashlight on for very long at any given time because it would be a, you know, a giveaway that someone was trying to come up the mountain.
Wow. Wow, so risky. So you recount how this family, they finally make it to the soldiers. The wife says, it's all right if we die here hungry, we're safe. This is the best moment of my life. What does her husband, Ayham Ali, have to say about life in Mosul under ISIS?
As you've probably read and heard, it's pretty grim. Aside from all of the restrictions on dress and behavior and smoking, aside from all of that, there's the fact that Mosul has been essentially cut off from commerce and interchange with the rest of Iraq for the better part of 2 years now. So the economy is completely shot, of course. There's no work. There's no money. The markets have gone empty. There's very little to eat.
James, propaganda is a huge part of ISIS control. And in some of these ISIS-controlled areas, there are big TV screens, jumbotrons, posted in major intersections and plazas. What is broadcast on those screens?
I spoke to people from Fallujah and Mosul who described these screens that were erected at public squares and in intersections. And in the instances of both cities, they said that what was being projected on the screens were public executions. Cameras were set up at the execution grounds. In the case of Mosul, it was at a cemetery, and that beheadings were broadcast live, and that people were forced to watch, locals, including children.
And were there crowds, small or large, watching at those squares?
To be honest, I don't know.
I'd like you to tell us about two ISIS survivors you met after the battle for Kayara. One's name is Muhammad, the other is Abdullah. And they're old friends, but they meet again as they're escaping the city. What do they tell you about life under ISIS?
Of course, they recounted all of the things that you hear from residents living under ISIS in other parts of Iraq. But what made their account particularly interesting and telling was they described the boredom, the tedium of living under ISIS. Other than prayer and the occasional bout of violence, there was very little to do. These guys, Abdullah and Muhammad, knew each other from playing soccer. They weren't allowed to do that. They're both pretty avid smokers, like many Iraqi men are. They weren't allowed to do that. They weren't allowed to speak with girls. They weren't allowed to speak on the phone. People weren't allowed to have phones, or at least not functioning phones. They didn't have any work, and they had nowhere to go. So it's endlessly frightening and endlessly tedious. The signal feature of life under ISIS after constant fear is constant boredom.
James Verini with National Geographic, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The battle for Mosul has become a talking point in the U.S. elections. Republican candidate Donald Trump has criticized the Obama administration for failing to use the element of surprise in the run-up to the fight. He says Generals Patton and MacArthur would be turning in their graves. This seems like a fair issue to discuss, so the world's resident military historian Chris Wolf joins us. So did the U.S. forfeit surprise in the battle for Mosul, Chris?
I think the first thing to clarify, Marco, is that this is not really a U.S. decision. The U.S. is just one partner amongst many in an Iraqi-led operation. There's a host of allies with very competing agendas. There's international powers like Turkey and Iran. Then there's a host of competing Iraqi actors as well, most notably the Kurds and the official government army. But there's also a variety of Shiite militias with different agendas, a pro-Baathist militia, Christian groups. So it'd be a challenge, to say the least, to ask all of these fragile partners to keep a secret.
Right. So first stop in any military strategy is to collaborate. So let me rephrase the question. Did the Iraqi government and its allies forfeit the element of surprise?
Well, I would say at first glance, they probably did, at least at the strategic level, with the Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi broadcasting to the city's residents to hunker down, a massive leaflet campaign warning citizens that the attack was coming. However, there's a distinction to be made between what you call a strategic surprise and a tactical surprise. There's a difference between the enemy knowing what your ultimate objective is and knowing how the attack's going to come. And also, you can't hide massive physical preparations that are clearly visible, especially in an open society full of sympathizers and spies. However, you can still achieve tactical surprise locally by coming at an unexpected hour from an unexpected direction with an unexpected force.
Now, in the second debate between Clinton and Trump, moderator Martha Raddatz seemed to get kind of frustrated with Trump's assertion that the fight for Mosul would not work because the U.S. military had telegraphed the attack for months. And she told him there are many reasons why these things are talked about, including propaganda points to be scored. Explain that.
Yeah, there's plenty of reasons why surprise is not an advantage. One is psychological, like Martha Raddatz was alluding to, where, you know, the very knowledge that an overwhelming force is coming against you can be intimidating in its own right. Then there's the investment of prestige in, if you know that, you know, Mosul is important to ISIS, they're telling you that it's important. Suddenly there's their reputation on the line, and that can draw them into battle, make them commit more resources than they might otherwise have done. And then if your ultimate goal is to attrit those resources, then that's a good tactic. And then obviously there is the political need. Sometimes the political need outweighs the military imperative, and that could be domestic or international politics.
Still, it sounds like there's still many reasons why surprise attacks are useful and that it would be a bad idea to tear that chapter out of the military playbook. You've been a student of military history your whole life, Chris. What is your judgment on Mosul? Was surprise thrown away?
Now, I'm going to reserve judgment until I've seen the confidential documents or read the memoirs of the key players who can provide the proof for that. But I would be willing to put forward a hypothesis that, in fact, yes, surprise was thrown away deliberately for political reasons, and not for the political reasons that Donald Trump is suggesting, that it was to help Hillary Clinton. That seems absurd to suggest that you could get a massive coalition of these very disparate Iraqi and international forces together at this time for such parochial political reasons. I'd rather suggest that the element of surprise was forfeited for Iraqi domestic political reasons. They need to galvanize their resources and their political support amongst a very diverse and fractured society. And secondly, as I mentioned before, this is not a coherent, disciplined force. And a consequence of that is that every advance is a political statement and a challenge as to, you know, which coalition force occupies which village, every single village. You know, a Kurdish movement into an Assyrian Christian village could trigger all kinds of problems. A Shia militia advance into a Sunni village could create even more problems. You know, these are all controversial issues. They're probably negotiated well in advance to avoid antagonisms or even infighting. You know, the most important thing to success is to keep that coalition together, much more important than maintaining the element of surprise. So most likely, in my judgment, surprise in Mosul was not even an option, but we'll need to wait for history to make the final judgment.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, in Pakistan, most people think police work is a man's job. But this veteran police woman in Islamabad is positive she's better at it than the men.
I'm better than you. Come on. No question about it.
We kick off our new series, Balance of Power, on women, American money, and Pakistan, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Today, we launch our latest Across Women's Lives series. We'll spend the next 2 weeks looking at the impact U.S. foreign policy has on women around the world. We're calling this Balance of Power, and the focus this week is on Pakistan. I've got Christina Asquith with me, the editor for Across Women's Lives, and we'll be speaking more in a moment, Christina, about American money overall for women all over the globe. But set up first what we're about to hear from reporter Carolyn Beeler.
So the U.S. spends, or is projected to spend, $8 million increasing women's presence in peace and security in Pakistan. This is one woman's story of what that $8 million looks like from the ground.
All right, thanks a lot. We'll be back in a moment with you. And here's The World's Carolyn Beeler in Islamabad.
This is what it's like on the side of a highway outside of Islamabad. Motorcycles with five people on them whiz past me. Motorized rickshaws and cattle trucks compete for space in the same lane.
Just give 5 minutes, you will see truck, motorcycle, car, tractor trolley, and so many other vehicles.
None of this is surprising for most Pakistanis. But this woman, Asma Naqvi, she is surprising because she's a cop.
When I came here, it was a big shock for these people because I'm the only female who's working in the field.
Naqvi is letting me ride along in her cruiser north of Islamabad.
You guys wear helmets and drive on the side.
She's a 15-year veteran of the National Highways and Motorways Police, and she spots lawbreakers quickly and often.
Assalamu alaikum. Lessons?
Naqvi writes a driver a ticket. He was picking up passengers on the shoulder instead of at the bus stop down the road.
When I asked him why you did that, he said, I was taking the lady passengers. And just to get a sympathetic side from me.
Back in the car, Naqvi tells me people try to talk their way out of tickets by playing to her gender all the time. It doesn't work. She just recites the law and insists they pay their fee.
I am polite, but I am firm as well.
Polite, but firm. Like many women, she says she feels she has to be better at her job than a man would have to be.
Any doubt? Come on, ma'am. I'm better than them. Come on. No question about it.
Naqvi's grandfather was a police officer, and that inspired her to go into law enforcement. But she is among a tiny minority. Fewer than 1% of Pakistani police officers are women. The international average is around just 9%.
Right now, there's a real tremendous gap in terms of female representation in police forces globally.
That's Allison Peters from the Washington-based advocacy group Inclusive Security. She says this gap, it's a problem.
We know that women police can more often easily build trust with local populations, have been shown to decrease human rights abuses, and have been shown to limit the use of excessive force and more efficiently de-escalate tension.
Even in giving out simple traffic tickets, Naqvi's ranking officer, Mirza Belol, says women are better at keeping the peace.
He thinks that when making an interaction with some stranger on the road, the dealing of the women's is much better than the men's.
With all this in mind, the U.S. government in 2011 launched a plan to increase the presence of women in peace and security forces globally as an effort to try to fight terrorism more effectively. The State Department has requested more than $8 million for the effort in Pakistan next year. U.S. money pays for running workshops for female officers, building women's complaint rooms at police stations, and buying vans so female cops can get to work. Allison Peters says it's making a difference. Pakistani women have started to rise in the officer ranks.
So we have a woman that's serving as a deputy inspector general of police, which is one of the highest ranks a policeman or woman can serve at. It's not something that will happen overnight, but slowly but surely we are seeing progress.
Where they're not seeing progress is in the total number of female officers. That has remained stagnant since 2011. Kola Iram oversaw a now-defunct women's policing program in Pakistan for 6 years and says the forces aren't targeting women in hiring.
This is a patriarchal society. Police is still a man's domain in Pakistan. So recruitment is a big issue because if you talk to the senior management, they think that we don't need women.
And many women who are on the job work at women's only stations where they feel sidelined. Most aren't even allowed to file basic police reports.
In women police stations, women were mainly dealing with small family issues. But if there was a case of a murder, even if a woman was murdered or a case of sexual assault, rape, they were not allowed to deal with that.
Asma Naqvi's department is seen as the best in the country for women officers. And Naqvi has been happy there. She says she's a police officer, full stop. It's not a question of male or female.
I'm the police officer and that's it. No male, no female. We all are the police officers without any discrimination. Let me know a single thing that this man can do and I can't do.
But she still works in a man's world. She remembers the time when a driver she pulled over scolded her for not wearing a headscarf. She yelled right back at him.
Because who the hell is he to stare at on us? Maybe we are covering the head. Whatever we are doing, it's none of anybody's business.
Naqvi says women should know their value and have the guts to let other people know. She hopes when girls see her on patrol, they'll be inspired to stand up for their rights too. Maybe someday as a police officer.
A journey of the 1,000 miles begins with the single step. And I'm that single step.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Islamabad.
Our coverage of women's lives in Pakistan came about because we had this simple question. How much does the U.S. government spend on programs that impact women worldwide? Well, joining me again to get a handle on that is Christina Asquith, the editor of our Cross Women's Lives project. What is Washington's strategy, Christina, towards improving women's lives around the globe? Is there one?
There is one, and that was the very question after hearing so much talk about women in foreign policy in the election coverage, we wanted to know. So we investigated and looked at the State Department budget, saw a gender line item since about 2011, with an average about between 1 and 1.8 billion now spent every year on improving women's lives around the world.
I mean, that seems like a lot, but of course, everything is relative. Where does it go?
It is relative, $1 billion out of a $62 billion State Department budget, and it's still not as much in absolute terms as, say, a country like Sweden has spent on promoting women's rights around the world. Nonetheless, it is a lot of money, and it goes to try and improve women's lives around the world for moral and ethical reasons. We are dealing still with societies in which women are terribly oppressed. More than half women around the world, for example, give birth without even a medical professional present. There's abject poverty, there's violence against women, and the U.S. would say we have a real moral obligation to try and make a difference. But it's more than that now. There's also a real case that's being made that inequality and oppression of women creates a tremendous amount of instability in society. And if you can address that instability, you can do things like eradicate poverty and even combat radicalization. So there's kind of foundational issues there that the U.S. wants to address, and improving women's lives may just be one way to do that.
There are some criticisms, aren't there, that the U.S. takes this money to places where women's issues actually don't impress a lot of people.
Definitely. When you talk about reducing illiteracy, it's fairly non-controversial, and that is where a lot of the $1.3 billion goes. But there are thornier areas. I remember, for example, when I was reporting from Iraq, the U.S. spent almost $1 million creating a women's center, and they did everything from plant beautiful flowers in the desert to bring in computers, and the Iraqi women would come and sit in circles and hear training on how they could empower themselves economically. And then when I stepped out of the women's center and crossed the street, there was a shabby police station with a bunch of male officers sitting on dusty floors and wondering, you know, what the heck was going on across the street? Why was the U.S. spending all their money over there? It created a lot of tension, and rumors started that inside the women's center, they were showing pornography or they were conducting abortions. There was just that kind of suspicion and tension when we saw the U.S. get behind empowering women, perceivably at the expense of men.
Right. So perception is a big issue.
Absolutely.
How does the U.S. government compare with other countries in terms of spending on women? What about other countries in the industrialized world?
Definitely. In addition to Sweden, Australia is talking about it. The Canadian foreign minister has said they're going to conduct a foreign policy through a gendered lens. So more and more you're seeing heads of state recognize that there could be real benefits, and they're putting a lot of money behind it, too.
So before I let you go, Christina, just give us a quick peek at what we'll be looking at in the rest of the series.
So over the next 2 weeks, Across Women's Lives, we'll be reporting from Pakistan, looking at how women are being affected by U.S. foreign policy there, and also from Colombia, looking at U.S. efforts to integrate women in the peace process there. Also, we're on social media.
Right. And that social media part of the whole series is asking the billion-dollar question. If you listeners, had $1 billion to spend on women in your country, what would you do? Tweet your answers at Women's Lives on Twitter. That's at Women's Lives using the hashtag Balance of Power. And tomorrow, you're going to hear from ninth graders from Lawrence, Massachusetts, the immigrant city. They took their stab at the billion-dollar question. Christina Asquith, editor of the world's Across Women's Lives series. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
About 3 weeks ago, Hurricane Matthew slammed the southern coast of Haiti, and in its wake, a humanitarian disaster. We hear that aid groups have still only reached a portion of the estimated 1.4 million people in need. So some communities and their local leaders are taking matters into their own hands. Amy Bracken reports from Trou-Bois, Haiti.
We are driving through southwestern Haiti, rushing to reach our destination hours away. And we're passing people on the road who wave their hands or yell things like we're hungry. So at random, I ask the driver to stop anywhere, and we approach a house. A group of locals are gathered on the porch, and the crowd grows when we arrive. They say we're in an area called Trou-Bois. They tell me they're short on water and food and rattle off a list of other needs. But in the conversation, one name keeps coming up, Madame Erta. A young woman in the crowd says so many people lost their homes that every night 250 cram into the house of Madame Erta. She's the one who takes care of us, the woman explains. Another voice in the crowd says Madame Erta got clothes for them after theirs were lost in the rubble. And then I hear a man say, "Here's the madame who's responsible for us." And a smiling, middle-aged woman arrives, sporting bright, clean clothes and a touch of perfume.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir, madame. C'est Erta Papillon.
Erta Papillon.
Oui, moi responsable. Moi responsable.
Her name is Erta Papillon. And she says, yes, I'm in charge. There hasn't been a single Haitian public official coming here to see what's going on. So all that's being done in the community, it's me that's doing it, along with them. Papillon takes my hand and leads me up the road.
La Camilla, nous avons 250 personnes qui dorment chaque soir.
250 people are sleeping in my house every night, she says. I'll show you. We enter, and she first takes me into a room where a woman is lying on a mattress with bandages on her hip and ankles. She was hit by a piece of metal roof with nails in it and injured badly, Papillon says. The woman tells me the pain is so bad she can't sleep at night. Papillon is making use of her past experience as a nurse. We dressed her wounds here, and we got some ibuprofen, she says, but we'll have to go to the hospital soon. This is where everyone sleeps, Papillon says. We cleared out the chairs so everyone could fit. Mattresses lean against the wall. In the center of the house, a woman prepares dinner, hammering away with a mortar and pestle. After the hurricane, I ran out and found people in their homes who were dying or badly injured, Papillon says. I'll show you a picture of a parent who died with his little child. She pulls from her wallet a photo of a father and young son posing together in better times. They died of exposure in the storm, Papillon says. The child was 6 years old. She also tells me about a woman who died here.
I put some hot water under her feet and put some blanket for her, and at 3 o'clock she died. It was, for me, it's a very, very difficult time in my life. Very hard.
Now we're heading down the hill to see Erta's orphanage. And I'm beginning to realize that it's true. She seems to be running everything here. And below the orphanage is the school she founded. Papillon grew up here and then spent time in Port-au-Prince in the U.S. But, she says, I chose to return to live here. For her projects, a church in Illinois and an organization called Haiti Children's Outreach raise funds. And now they're stepping up the appeals. Half of the orphanage lost its roof in the storm, same for the school. And local income is gone. Like her neighbors, Papillon lost almost all of her crops. And a pipe, once bringing clean water, has broken. Right now, she's trying to get drinking water to the remote houses. Papillon has two children of her own, now living in Florida, but she's seen as a mother to the community. Mama is what some locals call her, a nickname she has not warmed to. I don't want them to say that, she says. I'm just providing a service because it's really sad. The situation is really complicated. For the World, Amy Bracken, Toubois, Haiti.
Just ahead, the Day of the Dead comes to life in Mexico City like it never has. You're with the World. The U.S. had some decent relations with Russia for some years after the end of the Cold War, but then Putin, and it wasn't as if Vladimir Putin was the kind of person to build bridges, unless we're talking about a literal bridge to Crimea. Russia, you'll remember, annexed Crimea from neighboring Ukraine a couple of years ago, and soon after, Putin launched a multi-billion dollar project to link the Crimean port of Kerch with the Russian mainland. My BBC colleague Oleg Boldyrev checks out the progress so far.
On a good day, you can see Crimea from the Russian side of the Kerch Strait. But seeing is not enough. After annexing Crimea in 2014, Russia wants a physical link to its newest province. Especially now that the land border between Crimea and Ukraine is all but shut. And so, from the Russian shore on the Taman Peninsula, a giant causeway is snaking into the distance, punctuated by huge cranes and towering pylons. You say Black Sea, and most Russians automatically think of sun, summer holidays, but in fact it's very windy right now and very cold. This weather is a very useful reminder that the only bridge which ever stood in this place only lasted for a few months before being crushed by ice in 1945. Bridge designers say they are more prepared this time. Workers weld together giant pipes which will make one pylon. Thousands of those pylons are being hammered up to 90 meters into the silty bottom of the shallow sea. One by one, over 19 kilometers of the route. The price tag of this five-year project is a staggering $3.5 billion. This means that this year's share is more than half of the annual road-building budget for the entire country. But, as with anything involving Crimea, there isn't a public discussion on whether it's actually needed. Political will drives it forward. If not for President Putin, we wouldn't have this project, says a builder called Maxim, as he fixes metal rods for a roadbed. He and his colleagues are in no doubt that the bridge is needed. They say they are proud to be part of this massive operation. But the contract, all financed by the state, went to a company owned by President Putin's friend, a building mogul called Arkady Rotenberg. The businessman and his company, Stroygazmontaj, are under Western sanctions imposed after Crimea's annexation. But the firm's construction director, Sergei Ryzhenkin, insists this hasn't seriously hampered the project or made it more expensive.
I cannot say this seriously limits our company. Yes, it's inconvenient, and getting some spare parts from our machinery may be a bit more difficult. But in general, contractors from Russia have enough expertise and equipment to deliver on time.
And so, sunshine or bitter winds, the work goes on. The first cars are supposed to roll onto this bridge by the end of 2018. The company building it says it will last at least 100 years.
That report from my colleague at the BBC, Oleg Boldyrev. Finally, remember the opening scene of the 2015 James Bond film Spectre? It is pretty memorable. It begins with a massive Day of the Dead parade on the streets of Mexico City. There are towering skeleton puppets, people in costumes, in masks, and lots of music. Of course, it ends with a shootout and an awesome fight scene in a helicopter over the Zocalo, the main square. The only problem? There is no Day of the Dead parade in Mexico City, but now, inspired by the film, the city is planning one, and it'll take place next weekend. Monica Campbell is our reporter based in Mexico City, so why hold a Day of the Dead parade if they never did it before?
Mexico City's tourism official, or the main minister here, he actually said, you know, that after the Bond movie, and this is a quote, tourists are going to come looking for the carnival. And, you know, what happens if they don't find it? So they're very upfront and transparent about why they're doing this. And it's interesting. I mean, there's some major ads in publications in the United States, one of them being The New Yorker, that has, you know, multi-page ads for Day of the Dead in Mexico City. And there are stills from the James Bond film in those ads. So they have to create that if that's what they're really advertising.
So how do people in Mexico City feel about this parade coming up?
There's a lot of eye rolling. I think it's seen as kind of a sad stunt in this idea that they need to create it. This James Bond recreation is kind of silly. At the same time, I'm guessing that a number of families will turn out and see, you know, what kind of show they're actually going to put on.
So give us the authentic side of this, Monica. How do people actually celebrate Day of the Dead in Mexico? And are there any elements from Spectre that are accurate?
Yeah, the opening shot has skeletons and painted skulls and that sort of thing. And that is part of Mexico's Day of the Dead. So there are elements there. What you don't see is this large-scale procession. What you do see, is a very intimate type of celebration, a very intimate type of holiday where people go to cemeteries, they go to graves of their loved ones, they put down like their favorite food, you know, maybe their favorite bottle of tequila. You have families spread out, kind of a picnic, and some families spend the entire night at the gravesite talking about this loved one who's died. And the idea is that putting out these special photos and, you know, maybe a bottle of tequila is a way of welcoming back the spirit. And it's a holiday that's pre-Hispanic. It's indigenous. So in indigenous towns in Mexico, it's amazing. You know, places in Michoacan, the state of Michoacan, or Oaxaca. But it's a very quiet, intimate family celebration. It's not adult Halloween.
Just curious, you're seeing a lot more tourists this year because of the product placement of the city?
Well, apparently the number of tourists coming to Mexico City, it's going up, and they've done a lot. It's not just this type of publicity, but Mexico City has been really aggressive in advertising the city, and there's been a lot of payoff. I think they're actually trying to build up this Day of the Dead celebration, kind of like Rio does its Mardi Gras.
But no tourists have asked you yet where James Bond lives.
A number of people have asked me after seeing the James Bond film.
Are you serious?
They've asked me, they said, wow, is that what it's like? I mean, generally curious, you know, not, how are you supposed to know, right? And I've said, it's not like that, but it's really special. I mean, if you want to come, it's an amazing time of year to come because it is a very special holiday and there's a way to witness it and there's a way to participate in it, but it's not James Bond 007 Daniel Craig flying through the place. You know, it's not yellow filtered. but it's really a special holiday, but it's kind of sad that they feel that there's this need to like blow it up and exaggerate it as if the real thing isn't good enough.
Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. If you want to follow me on Twitter, pretty easy. My handle is at Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.